So let's move on with our week in review. And joining us now is Joan Vinocchi. She's a columnist for the Boston Globe. And Joan, happy Friday to you. Great to have you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Also with us is Craig Sandler, general manager of State House News Service. And good to have you back, Craig. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. A pleasure, Anthony.
Well, let's start with crime and justice this week, which seems like a sensible transition from David Boeri's story. The Massachusetts House and Senate both approved by substantial margins a controversial three-strikes habitual offender bill. Lawmakers have been debating some form of this bill for nearly a decade. It now goes to Governor Deval Patrick. If signed, the new law would eliminate the possibility of parole for repeat criminal offenders. Here's Representative David Linsky, Democrat from Natick.
There is a small number of people who repeatedly commit serious violent crime, and those are people that we have an obligation to protect the public from.
Opponents, including Black and Latino legislators, say it will cost too much and disproportionately penalize inmates of color. Here's Senator Cynthia Cream, a Democrat from Newton, who voted against it.
It would apply the maximum sentence in third strike cases, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the scope of the behavior that can be included within a specific crime.
So, Joan, let me start with you. Many states have tried three strikes and you're out laws and are now moving away from them. What's your take on why Massachusetts is on the verge of approving the law now?
Well, this is the opposite of a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, it's taken 12 years to get to this point, and it could very well be that, as you say, we're not ahead of the curve, we're way behind it, and other states that have tried it have found that it doesn't work. But we had one very high-profile case involving the shooting of a police officer, and that did trigger a real emotional reaction.
Yeah.
Political pressure on Beacon Hill.
Craig, let me ask you about that political pressure. Joan mentioned that the shooting death of a Woburn police officer, that was back in 2010, shot by a parolee. The bill is known as Melissa's Law. It got the name from a 27-year-old woman who was raped and killed in 1999. So given all that, was this the result of emotion or real evidence that these laws work?
Well, I mean, I, of course, will put it in a political frame, and it's worth knowing, you know, noting that 2010 is a long time ago. So I think that that's very slow reflexes, if it was a reflex reaction. I think it has more to do with the climate in general in and around that building. We're on the House side. You know, the speaker definitely is suffering some problems with reputation and perception of the whole institution and him, which we'll get to in a minute. The Senate president has a tough race in her district, and this is a reasonably straightforward, easily digestible, and popular piece of legislation to pass. And, you know, I think that most people who go to the polls would have a hard time making a case against doing it, though a lot of people in the building can make very cogent arguments against it. But, you know, given the climate, It's interesting. I don't know how you can apply a quick fix so slowly, but that's what they're doing.
Well, Joan, what do you think, I mean, just in general, of three strikes, Bill? I mean, three strikes and you're out kinds of laws. Do we have evidence that they actually work? Because it seems to me they can make politicians feel good about proposing them and passing them. But I spent a lot of time this week looking for that sort of empirical evidence that actually suggests they actually make people safer.
Well, they aren't deterrents, and they have in other states proven to just, you know, load up the prison system and end up, you know, costing a lot of money. But again, it is one of those easy fixes that sounds good, and again, there was so much emotion and political pressure, and I think it does say something that even in Massachusetts, or finally in Massachusetts, the political climate is such that the House and the Senate would go along with this.
Yeah, and I mean, I also, it gets pointed out sometimes about the death penalty that maybe it's not even deterrence. Maybe it's justice. Maybe it's just the way things ought to be. And I don't denigrate that. I think that sometimes we, particularly in the policy setting realm, you know, tend to undervalue the role of reasoned emotion in driving policy. And I think this might be a case of it. It does
Well, as you said, it's been they've been reasoning or at least talking about it for a long, long time. Finally, Craig, very, very quickly on this last point, Governor Patrick has said he would sign a law that balances law enforcement with a credible sort of nod toward rehabilitation. Is he going to sign this? Do we know that?
I think he's going to send it back with recommendation for amendment, which is in his purview. Formal sessions end on the 31st. But I think that he what I expect, and I could be wrong, but I expect that he's going to send it back with a recommendation that judges get a little more leeway than they have now. That's going to be very interesting if he does. He may also want to avoid getting into the politics of that. Mm. But if he doesn't send it back with recommendation for amendment, Anthony, I owe you a Coke Zero.
Okay, I'm going to take you up on that.
Okay.
Let's move on to the deepening scandal at the State Department of Probation. This week, two former aides to former probation commissioner John O'Brien were granted immunity from prosecution in exchange for their testimony against their former boss. O'Brien is facing charges of racketeering, conspiracy, and basically running a sham hiring system. So what does this mean in the ongoing state and federal investigations into the department? Here's Paul Ware, a Boston attorney who conducted the investigation into charges of patronage at the probation department in 2010.
In my personal view, there certainly will be significant, highly placed individuals who will be formally charged. I'd be very surprised if we're not in for some significant indictments.
So, Joan, the two people who've been granted immunity, Eddie Ryan, Jack O'Brien's political liaison, and Francis Wall, who was in charge of the hiring process, it would seem that this is a pretty significant step in the investigation.
Right. It sounds a lot like the formula that preceded the Sal DeMasi case, where, you know, two people close to him, prosecutors were able to, you know, grant them immunity and get them to flip. And that, of course, puts more pressure on the person that they're really zeroing in on.
Yeah. And let's remind listeners that this whole case grew out of a Globe Spotlight team investigation that suggested that the whole probation department was pretty much set up to give jobs to the politically connected. With that in mind, what kind of reaction, what kind of concern, what kind of hubbub is there on Beacon Hill this week about this?
As you can imagine, it must be a really dreadful feeling to know this stuff is coming, and it is. And there's just a palpable distraction. This is an important time of year in terms of making and passing laws, but everybody has one eye cast askew because these are, well, certainly in the case of the speaker, these are the most significant, most important people up there, and it casting a pall isn't quite the right word. I mean, it's, as you know, it's like the car wreck phenomenon. It's so thrilling. I'm not saying that the legislators are, but the community, it's so thrilling to be involved in crisis or, difficulties like this, that there is some of that going on. Everybody wants to talk about that and not about interestingly,
not about legislation.
Well, parole reform, which is a bit ironic, although those are federal charges.
I think it's never a good thing when politicians like the speaker have to put out statements basically saying, I am not a crook.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of that, Joan, I want to come back to your point, but let's listen to House Speaker Robert DeLeo answering questions about his level of concern this week. Here it is.
Am I worried about, possibility of indictment? No, I'm probably not. I haven't done anything wrong. But on the other hand, I'm really concerned about public perception.
Public perception? I mean, is that the issue here, Joan?
Well, I think that's an interesting point because there isn't really, it's hard to tell just how engaged the public is in this scandal. Mm. Beacon Hill seems a lot more into it than the general public. But it certainly doesn't make them look very good, the fact that they, have to look over their shoulder to see, the federal prosecutors breathing down their neck.
Yeah, and by the way, they cannot deny that the perception of the place has already been badly damaged by behavior that they do not deny. Some of the people who were hired, including DeLeo's relative, who's the youngest parole, became the youngest parole officer in Massachusetts history. That was in the Ware report, and no one is denying the findings of the Ware report. And that's really what's damage the perception.
Mm. Well, let's move on to the brief hostage crisis that we were following this week. Two Boston area residents were kidnapped while traveling on a religious pilgrimage in Egypt. Lisa Alphonse of Everett and Michelle Lewis, a pastor from Dorchester, were later released. While they were still being held hostage, some big name Massachusetts politicians were getting involved in trying to rescue the hostages, as well as to keep their families here informed. Here's Senator Scott Brown.
My office is obviously keeping the families involved and giving them the information that they need, you know, drawing that connection with the State Department and giving the State Department any information they need about the families and about the family members that were kidnapped.
Joan, you wrote this week about this, how this sort of played out politically between the state's two senators. What happened here?
Well, I think the interesting point is that, you know, back in the days when we had Senator Kennedy and Senator Kerry, you would never have sort of any kind of public squabbling over who should get credit. And I think that was sort of a testament to the two offices working together and each knowing their role. In this case, I think behind the scenes, Senator Kerry, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was, you know, working the phones and trying to make things happen. And Senator Brown was, I think, working the families and giving them a cell phone number.
That's a nice touch, right? Giving them a cell phone number.
And it's a testament to Senator Brown's real talent for just sort of retail politics. Behind the scenes, I think there was some unhappiness about who got the credit for it.
Yeah. Craig, what do you hear in this back and forth between
the
senators?
It's so familiar. And first of all, you go, Vinaki. That was a good piece. And I, but I, you know.
It was a fun piece.
Read that way. I think that, you know, it's classic of both guys. It's so Brownian to swoop down in a nice way and do his part. I don't deny that he did. And it's so classically Kerry to be chippy about it. You know, I mean, you know, how troubling would it have been? And in fact, how much trouble would it have been for the Kerry people to put out the message, we're really happy that the junior senator was able to play his part in this, as opposed to, well, you know, which is kind of has long been known as the Kerry modus. It's just that, you know, when you're 63 and you've been serving for 30 years, I don't know. I think it's unseemly to...
It did look a little petty. And yeah. I think, you know, it also was classic Kerry that... Who knows who exactly did what?
Yeah.
But he called the family on Monday, whereas Brown called the family on Friday. And that personal touch, that connection in politics, really means something to people.
Yeah. And Kennedy wouldn't have been complaining. What does that mean?
You know, and he might have spoken to them earlier as well.
Yeah, good point.
All right,
or had somebody else do it.
All right, well, let's move on. Yep. Yesterday, new state job numbers came out. And for the first time this year, the state actually lost jobs, 2,600 of them. The unemployment rate stayed steady at 6%, and state leaders say they're not worried. Here's Labor Secretary Joan Goldstein.
Well, to date, we certainly think we are in better shape and continuing to grow and improve. We are expecting that it will continue throughout the rest of 2012.
But, Craig, job losses, never a good thing, no matter how small, especially this close to election. What kind of fallout do you see this happen?
You know, in Massachusetts, relatively limited. You know, the only people running this year in the state are reps and senators, and they don't lose their jobs over a few months of employment data. Presidents do. Deval Patrick's mostly interested right now in that race, and you could argue properly so. And it's part of a picture, Barack goes, so goes Deval, that looks familiar if you look at the national scene. Things are not getting better as quickly as they should and also as they need to for both of those guys to succeed. And, you know, we've heard for a long time that the job force is actually shrinking because people are getting discouraged. Now we're also losing jobs. That's a double whammy, and these guys will be called to account.
Joan, what's your reaction to these job numbers? We take it for granted that Massachusetts has been doing so much better. I think it was sort of startling to some people to say, really? They went down this week, or this month, or last month, rather.
I agree with Craig's assessment. Deval Patrick was reelected basically because he was able to make the case that we turned the corner. Massachusetts was doing so much better than everywhere else, and everything was pointing in the right direction. The challenge now is for, you know, Barack Obama to somehow, he can't make that case. There are no numbers that support that. So I think it's more of a problem for Patrick via his concern for Obama than it is for, you know, Patrick as governor of Massachusetts.
Right. Yeah, I mean, how bad is it that, in fact, we still are doing significantly better than the nation, even after this batch of bad numbers?
Mm, good point. So let's move on to our hubbub, that story that didn't quite make it above the fold that might have caught your attention. And let me start with you, Craig Sandler.
Well, you know, I don't usually go in this direction, but I just have to in this case because it was an interesting facet of the week. I live in Arlington and was in my parking lot underneath that microburst while it occurred a couple of days ago. And it was instructive in so many ways. One of the things it instructed me about is I don't know enough about dangerous weather because I was never worried. But I'm also happy to say nobody got hurt. On the other hand, it put a lot of things in perspective. It was something to see, as you can imagine, which I will not belabor. But the sort of the larger picture for me is, boy, I'm glad we don't have a lot of that kind of stuff, and I'm glad we don't have trailer parks, and it's very easy. You walk around my neighborhood now at the signs ripped through their bolts and the flags ripped off their halyards, never mind the trees and the streetlights. And you realize, we really have a good here, and in this case, we're actually lucky that nobody was hurt. So,
well, amen to that. Joan, your hubbub.
Well, my hubbub relates to something that was above the fold. Yesterday's Mitt Romney event in Roxbury, there was a picture that ran all over the country of Romney standing next to a big red tool chest. I don't know if you guys noticed it, but I was at the event, and I got there early enough to see them all to do all the setup, which I always find very interesting. And in this case, the setup included two attempts to clean up the tool chest. First, a worker came out, sprayed something, and wiped it down. Then a Romney campaign aide, you know, came up and sprayed some more and wiped it up get it gleaming.
Yeah.
And here's my kicker here. People think of politics as a dirty business, but in this case, it was about cleaning things up.
All right. There's some bright news about politics. Well, here's mine. My hubbub is not particularly local, but I just couldn't resist it because it made me laugh. This has to do with next week's London Olympics and the Spanish Olympic team, and the theme is that you get what you pay for. So the Spanish Olympic Committee wanted to save some dough, and so they got a Russian designer to design Spain's Olympic team's uniforms for free. The problem is they look awful, garish, red, yellow. They look like something you dress a toddler up to play in a sandbox. And some of the Spanish Olympians have been mocking them on social media networks. One Spanish athlete tweeted, "Have never worn anything so ugly in our lives." Meanwhile, the Spanish clothes designers are indignant that they weren't asked to do the job. But Spanish officials say, hey, you can't argue with the fact that they're free and saving us millions of dollars. So I guess you get what you pay for. Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for joining us today. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And Craig Sandler, general manager of State House News Service. Great to have you, and have
Thank
a great
you.
Weekend.
Stay out of the wild weather.
Stay with us. Up next, Congressman Barney Frank, co-author of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Bill, signed into law 2 years ago. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.